Welcome back to the program. Most of us have ambition. We want to succeed in our relationships and in the workplace. But to succeed, however, requires more than just hard work and intelligence. It often requires power. When we look around, we see that some people have power and others don't. Why is that? What are the skills we need to succeed, to acquire personal power, and to effectively wield that power for our own personal ends? 35 years ago, Michael Korda laid out a predicate for power. Today, our guest this morning, Jeffrey Pfeffer, is a leading thinker on the subject of power. In his new book, Power, he lays out a 21st century guide to how power works. It is my pleasure to have Jeffrey Pfeffer here on the program this morning. He's the Thomas D. Professor of Organizational Behavior at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University, where he's taught since 1979. He's the author or co-author of 13 books. He's also been a visiting professor at Harvard Business School. It is my pleasure to welcome Jeffrey Pfeffer to talk about his new book, Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Jeff.
Great to have you here. When you define power, what specifically do you mean?
Well, power is really the ability to get your way, to prevail in contests and struggles over differences of opinion. And sometimes I define power as the ability to never have to leave a job without wanting to, something that I think many of your listeners can relate to when they look around and they see many of their friends and colleagues who have lost positions. I have, there's an example in the book of a guy who did a very good job of building a leadership program for a large computer company, but because he never did a good job of building relationships inside the organization and worrying about who was out to get him, he wound up losing his job, even though objectively he had done a fabulous job on creating this excellent executive leadership program.
Much of what you talk about seems to be about the politics of relationships, the politics of the workplace, that really politics is what power is all about.
That is certainly correct. And I think one of the important points, which you made very nicely in the introduction, is that many people believe that they don't have to play politics, that they want to, and they don't want to really stoop to that level, that, you know, they want to just do a good job, keep their head down, and everything will be okay. And I wish the world worked that way, but it often does not.
Are these principles true in all companies, small and large? Is this something that's essentially universal when one looks at the workplace?
Well, it's hard to say if they're completely universal, but certainly, you know, I have examples in the book from people from India and Brazil and China and Europe and Mexico and from all kinds of countries, and I believe the principles are reasonably universal. And for me, I think the issue is not so much organizational size. You can look at relatively small law firms or accounting firms or even venture capital firms, which don't have huge numbers of people in them, but where, it's in the case, for instance, of Venrock, you know, on one day four partners got dismissed, including Tony Sun, who was the person who personally made many of his partners billions of dollars. So you can't really rely on the kindness of strangers or even perhaps your partners. Even in these relatively small firms, there's often a lot of politics.
One of the big questions that I know many people have about all of this is in terms of the allocation of time, the allocation of resources. How much of their workday should be spent politicking and doing the kind of things that will accumulate power versus the work itself?
Well, I'm not sure that, you know, oftentimes, if you define management as getting things done through other people, then to some extent, almost all their day should be probably spent building influence over others and figuring out how to get those folks to help them do their job. I think you raise a very interesting and important point, which is there is some trade-off involved, and I think that's going to depend very much on the situation. If you're in a position where it's a relatively politicized culture and there's a lot of conflict and disputes going on and there are factions, then you need to spend relatively more time worrying about your power base and how well you're interacting with other people. If you're in a place where there's less of that, then you can spend less time. So I think it depends very much on the kind of the context in which you're operating.
Have the principles of power and politics within organizations, many of the things that you talk about, have they been pretty consistent over time, or are we looking at a new paradigm given the speed of events and communication today?
I think the principles have been reasonably consistent, mostly because I think the things that motivate human behavior are reasonably consistent over time. We do things for people who are similar to us. We like people who are similar to us, and that probably goes back to our time, you know, on the plains of Africa or wherever our origins were, when we had to recognize who was the friends and who were the foes, and so we learned to recognize people who were similar and favor them. And similarly, I think most people throughout history have wanted to feel good about themselves, a kind of self-enhancement motive. And so we like people who flatter us and who make us feel good about ourselves and who don't contradict what we say. So I think because, you know, human psychology is reasonably unchanged, so I think are the principles of influence.
You lay out some pretty clear-cut principles of power in the book. Are these things, though, that people can really learn, or are there just some people, and we've seen them, that are kind of naturals at the political process, and those people will often get ahead first?
Well, you know, people will tell you that, you know, skill is inborn, but studies of genius in fields not only just ranging to power and politics inside of organizations, but, you know, dance, art, music, and so forth, those studies really show quite consistently that what is required to be successful and effective is practice. You know, I have a former student who said to me one day in class, he said, I don't find a lot of the stuff that you're talking about to be very natural, and so I'm not sure I could do it. And I looked at him without a moment's hesitation, and I said, do you ski? And he said, oh, yes. And I said, do you ski proficiently? And he said, oh, yes. And I said, when you first got up on skis, was skiing a natural act? And the answer, of course, was no. So it is clearly my experience, and there's evidence to suggest this, besides my anecdotal experience, that people can learn this and get slightly and get better at it. Now, and I think you also have to recognize the principle of compound interest, that you don't have to necessarily transform yourself completely or even overnight, that if you are slightly better or more effective in a variety of situations over time, that will bring you to a very, very different place, just as there's a big difference in the compounded return between 7% and 5% over time.
People that are skillful at these things tend to use the same techniques over and over again, particularly if they have worked for them in a specific environment. Is that a good idea, or do the techniques really need to change drastically to fit the circumstance?
Oh, the techniques definitely need to change to fit the circumstance. You have to match what you're doing to the people in the situation you're trying to influence. And, you know, some people are going to be responsive to rationale and to facts and to data. Other people are going to be much more susceptible to emotional appeals. And I think the most important thing people need to be able to do, and the most important skill they can develop, is the ability to put themselves in the other person's place, to see the world through their eyes so they can understand what is motivating them and then respond accordingly.
Talk about that, the importance of empathy and the idea of how you make the other person that you're dealing with, how you make them feel.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. I have a friend, Laura Esserman, who's I talk about in the book, who's tried to accomplish lots of things to change the delivery of breast cancer care. She's the director of a breast cancer center at University of California, San Francisco. And as a, you know, wonderful person who wants to do good, she at one point was sponsoring a mammography van to go into the poor sections of San Francisco and, diagnose women who would otherwise not have the access to mammography services. And this, of course, did not make her colleagues in the surgery department happy. The surgery department was running a deficit, number one. The CFO of the hospital was worried about bond ratings, for Mission Bay. And she could not understand why people didn't want to, in quotes, do the right thing. But, you know, once she recognized, you know, that the CFO had a set of issues that he was pushing, that her head of the Department of Surgery was wondering why surgery was basically sponsoring a mammography van and so on and so forth, she could understand why they didn't see the world quite as she did. And then she asked herself the next question, which is mammography the thing I really want to be putting all my effort behind? And the answer to that was no. And so as a consequence, she dropped the mammography van and got the support and, you know, much more cooperation from her colleagues. So that's an example of where if you put yourself in the other person's place and look at the world through their eyes, you can become more effective in figuring out what you want to do and why.
Another interesting example is something somebody wrote recently in an article. I mean, it has a political context in and of itself. Somebody was talking about the difference comparing Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and somebody made the point that if you spend time in a room with Barack Obama, you come away thinking he's the smartest person in the room. If you spend time with Bill Clinton, you come away thinking you're the smartest person in the room.
That is clearly the case. I'm not sure that's the case, since I've never spent any time with either one of them. But I think there are people who have the ability to make other people feel really good about themselves. And one of the ways to do that, I think, is to flatter people. You know, Jack Valenti, the late head of the Motion Picture Association of America, who held that job for 38 years, was the consummate flatterer. I remember when he came to my class and I had the privilege of hosting him. And, you know, I wrote him a very, very nice thank you letter because he was very important for the class to talk about holding power over a long career. And I will never forget, back on a copy of the letter I'd sent to him, he scrolled the following little line. He said, "This is the nicest thank you I've ever received." So he even flattered about relatively small and trivial things, but all of that makes you feel good about yourself and say, wow, here is this person who recognizes me and recognizes at least my efforts. So it is very important that you acknowledge the other person.
One of the things that we hear so much about, and you in a business school environment, I'm sure, are consumed with it, we hear so much about decentralization, about flattening out organizations, about environments in which the argument is made power is less critical. Is that true?
Absolutely not. I mean, as you look around, you know, there's still only one governor of California. As we see the recent election, there's only one school superintendent in the city of San Francisco or in any of the cities in the Napa Valley. There's only one CEO. There's only one, you know, managing director. There's only one Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs or one Tony Hayward of British Petroleum. So there is, I think, a lot of talk about how organizations are, and organizations are flatter, but the implication of a flatter organization simply means that there are fewer promotion opportunities and there are more people competing for them. So just because there are fewer levels, that just means actually the competition for the few promotions that are available will just be that more intense.
How has the speed of communication today impacted the ability to position for power?
Well, communication technologies, I think, have had a couple of effects. And one effect, which I think is not a good one, is that everybody believes they can do everything remotely or by text message. And, you know, again, to return to Jack Valenti, one of the things that made him so successful in running rings around the high-tech industry as they passed the Digital Media Copyright Act was, you know, the high-tech industry would send, you know, emails to Congress people and staff, and Jack would show up. I mean, first he would call, and if, you know, and sometimes he would actually show up in person. It is very, very hard, I think, to be charming by email. It is much easier to be charming in person, if you're assuming you have those capabilities. So one of the things I think people have come to do is rely too much on remote communication and unnecessarily de-emphasize the importance of actually being there, shaking people's hand, touching them on the arm, you know, sitting face to face.
And of course, because people are not doing that as routinely these days, it really does carry with it a huge competitive advantage.
That's completely correct.
Talk a little bit about other examples, some of the other people you mentioned, Jack Valenti, others that you outline in the book that really have understood these principles and used them so effectively.
Well, I think you mentioned Bill Clinton. He is clearly one. And his ability to make other people in the room feel that they were the center of attention is clearly, clearly an amazing skill. But one of the things I try to do in this book is talk not just about, you know, famous people that everybody in the universe would have heard of, because people will often say to me, I can't relate to those people. You know, I'm not Bill Clinton. I'm not Jack Welch. I'm not Bill Gates or whoever. And so I try to use examples of regular, normal, you know, or not completely normal, but regular people just beginning their careers. For instance, there's a Brazilian, Marcello. And Marcello, you know, had a job in finance in a Brazilian company. And like many people who work in organizations, he was doing a good job and working very effectively. He did, I think, two things that made him even more successful. Number one, he built a network with other people in other financial positions outside of his company so he could learn from them. And the second thing he did is he really developed a proactive media strategy. So he began writing articles and sending them to Brazilian business magazines. When people would call his company to do interviews, he was happy to take the calls, even though that diverted time from his regular job. And over time, he really built a very, very effective and potent public image. And so, you know, one day his picture appears on the cover of the leading Brazilian business magazine as part of a story, 10 CEOs of the Future. And if you are named as one of the 10 CEOs of the future, you don't have to, you know, it's not going to take very long before you're in the position which he now is, which is to be a CEO of a large Brazilian construction company. So, you know, there's someone who basically built a very effective media strategy from a relatively low-power position, and it worked out to get him to a much higher place.
What role, if any, does social networking play in this?
Well, networking is really critical for several reasons. First of all, people in your network can provide you information, including information about jobs and opportunities, and obviously people in your network can provide you help and advice, as well as that additional information and social support. The mistake that I think many people make is that we tend to spend most of our time with people that we already know and like, because that's, of course, what's most comfortable. But I tell people all the time that, you know, people who you already know and like well are probably in the same networks that you are and probably only can provide you with information that's similar to information that you already have. So you need to get out and meet new people. There was a student who came to Stanford who wanted to be in the biotech industry. He had no background in biotechnology. He knew nobody in that industry. But he began quite systematically to reach out to people and ask for advice, and then having met some people, he would introduce people he met to other people, thereby providing value. He always wrote a thank you note to the people who had given him time. And in a relatively short period of time, literally a period of months, he had built this amazing network in the biotech industry, which, not surprisingly, permitted him to get a good job when he graduated.
One of the things you talk about is the importance of always keeping the objective in sight. Talk about that.
Ah, yes. It's important to, for every situation, including situations of conflict, but it's important to keep your eyes on what you're trying to achieve. One of the things that I think gets people into lots of trouble is they forget what they're trying to achieve, like the Laura Esserman story I just mm-hmm. mentioned. You know, is mammography the most important diagnostic modality? No. Why are you fighting for it? Well, because I'm fighting because I fight. Similarly, you know, my dear friend Rudy Crewe, who was New York School's chancellor and then head of Miami-Dade County Schools, I think provides really good advice. He said, you know, if you're in a conflict, what would winning look like? Oftentimes, you know, we respond very emotionally to people. We say, oh, you know, Jeff Sheckman has, you know, bothered me, so I'm going to bother him back. I'm going to get back at the person. And we lose sight of what we're really trying to achieve. So the advice I would give people is, what does winning look like? And, you know, what are you really focused on? You keep your eyes on what you're really trying to achieve.
Talk a little bit in that context about the importance of keeping those objectives, even after you've reached whatever plateau you think has been your objective, that there's always something else that you have to keep at this.
You know, I have to keep active, but in the words of Andy Grove, who, you know, the former Intel CEO and co-founder, he wrote a book called Only the Paranoid Survive, and that's of course, he wrote this about companies and how Intel, in order to maintain its huge market share in the microprocessor industry, it had to never take anything for granted or let its guard down and continue innovating and competing. That's true for, I think, people inside organizations as well. We get to a high-level position, partner, CEO, whatever that position would be, and say, okay, we've arrived, and the rules no longer apply to me. But they do. And you have to continually re-engage and make sure you're doing things that are helpful and are providing value to the people around you. Even though I have a tenured position at Stanford, which I've held for 30 years, even though, in theory, I can't be fired, there's scarcely a day that I don't go to the office and think to myself, okay, I've got these colleagues in the organizational behavior group. What can I do to be helpful to them and to be useful to them so that they will still want me around? Even though, in theory, they can't fire me, I would never take for granted their support or their willingness, to provide value and help to me. And so, therefore, I'm always worrying about, my relationship with them, and am I providing value and doing things that will make them feel better about themselves.
Now that we have a more gender-balanced workplace, does that make any difference in any of these equations?
I can make a very important difference. There is quite a bit of research that suggests that both men and women are oftentimes reluctant to engage in some of these tactics of self-promotion and networking. Many of these things don't feel natural or right to people. But the evidence suggests that women, on average, are even more reluctant to do this than men. And part of that is because they're in this double bind, where if they behave in an aggressive fashion, they're not considered to be feminine. But if they don't behave in that similar or aggressive fashion, they don't get very far. So they really, I do think, face some difficult dilemmas. But my advice is that, and this is advice that I think emerges pretty clearly out of the literature, even though this sounds horrible and in some sense it's enormously unfair, for women to succeed, they have to adopt, I think, at least at this point in time, more, in quotes, male-oriented strategies, and they have to do the same thing, even if people don't like them. But as I said, this is something that affects men as well, and I think we need to get over, you can decide, do you want to be powerful, or do you want to be necessarily loved or liked by everybody? And the two often require, trade-offs. In order to be powerful, maybe you have to do some things that people won't necessarily like about you. And you can see this in cases, Rudy Giuliani, who's been a very powerful person, but doesn't necessarily have everybody loving him every minute.
Right. You talk also about Tina Brown and what she's accomplished with the political side.
No, that's exactly right. And to watch Tina Brown work a room and to watch Tina Brown put together first her magazines, The New Yorker and Vanity Fair, and now the website, The Daily Beast, this is a woman who is ambitious and focused and is concerned about the quality of the product and very concerned about making sure that she's in the center of, the conversation and communication networks. And she is, and she's willing to do what it takes to get there.
I want to talk for a moment about the quality of work, the quality of product, because even within the context of the broad political framework, one of the things you talk about is the importance of attention to detail.
Absolutely. We oftentimes don't understand the fact that if you do the small tasks, big rewards will follow. There's a person who I know who was working at a hedge fund, and, in the hedge funds, they have to recruit analysts, and this is considered to be not a very glamorous type of job because analysts come to a hedge fund or any financial services firm. They stay for a couple years or three, and then they go back to business school. So you're not even hiring people who are going to be there that long. So nobody really wanted to do this. Everybody kind of, this was like some kind of nasty task that had to be done, but it was not certainly very glamorous, and nobody was competing to do it. And this guy, Mike, said, I'll take this off your plate. I will, organize the schedules for these folks. I will, coordinate. And in that small task, several things happened. First of all, he interacted with all the analysts coming in, who would, of course, feel grateful to him because they would think he was responsible in some measure for them getting their job. That's number one. And number two, in coordinating schedules and organizing events, this naturally brought him into contact with more senior people in the firm. And so they got to know him better, and they were grateful for him for taking on this relatively mundane task, but a task that provided him access to many people, put him in the center of the communication network, and earned the gratitude of those others who were higher up in the organization.
One of the other things you talk about is burnout. That doing this, people sometimes tire of it, and then they lose power.
I think that's completely correct. It's, you know, any job, including, you know, acceding to and then maintaining a leadership position, requires a certain amount of effort, and people do get tired over time. People say, I'm tired of, you know, being on my toes and watching everybody else and worrying about other people all the time. And I think that's one reason why people sometimes lose power. I had a friend who started a small software firm, and he did pretty well, but after a while he got burned out and lost his kind of focus and attention, and the board brought in a CEO, and soon he was out of a job. And I think that story happens all the time. So when you are burned out, when you're tired, you should recognize this and get out before others throw you out.
Jeffrey Pfeffer, the book is Power: Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. It's just out from Harper. Jeffrey, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
And thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.